Overcoming adversity. That's what's coming up on The Art of Bombing, episode 218.
My friend Dan, he's got a podcast, cause all comics need a podcast, and nobody had a podcast called The Art of Bombing. So Dan went out and bought a tape deck. Who knows why he bought a tape deck? Podcasts don't get played on tape decks, but Dan is from the 80s. So hey there, all you funny jerks, come talk to Dan about your work. Tell him all about your worst times. It's The Art of Bombing.
Hello, friends, and welcome to another episode of The Art of Bombing. I'm your host, Dan Bublitz Jr. I hope everybody's doing well today. It is Tuesday, August 31st, 2021. Today on the show, and this is the Season 5 finale, and I am joined by Branson, Missouri-based comedian Joey Aiello. And we had a great conversation. But again, just a reminder, this is the season finale. I'm taking a hiatus. I don't know how long that hiatus will be, but when I come back, it will be season 6. I got to take a little break. I have some other projects I want to focus on. I've got to focus on school and some other personal things that I just can't quite talk about yet. Don't worry, they're positive things. I just can't talk about them yet. So I need to take a little break to do that. So I don't have an exact date as to when the podcast will be back. So if you want to keep up to date on everything that's going on with The Art of Bombing in the future, I suggest that you head over to theartofbombingpod.com and you subscribe to our monthly newsletter, because the newsletter will still be going out during the hiatus. So even though the podcast won't, there won't be new episodes of the podcast being released, there will be a newsletter coming out once a month. That way I can keep everybody updated on the hiatus and how long it will be. So if you're a subscriber and to the newsletter, you're going to be one of the first to know when the Art of Bombing podcast comes back. So I highly recommend that you do that. And if you haven't done so already, make sure you go to Apple Podcasts, leave us a 5-star review and a rating. That'll definitely help get the word out there, so when we come back, more people will be eager to listen to this podcast. And again, like I said, this is the hiatus, and don't have a lot to talk about business-wise before we get into this episode with Joey. The only real business I got to take care of is I need to congratulate the winner of the Art of Bombing hat. And the winner was a random drawing, and people got registered for the drawing by sharing our content during the month of August. And our winner is at Travis Medvich on Twitter. That is his Twitter username. So at Travis Medvich, you want an Art of Bombing hat. So in order to claim your hat, all you need to do is send a message via Twitter, direct message via Twitter with your mailing address. And when I get back from vacation next week, I will get your hat mailed out. Thanks to everybody that shared our content and got to register to be part of the contest. When we come back for season 6, I'll do another one. I don't know yet. It's too early to tell. Finally, if you like what we're doing, what I'm doing, you can always leave a little tip if you'd like. If you got a little extra money, you can do that by buying me a coffee at buymeacoffee.com/debubcomedy. But again, the best way to support the show is to tell somebody about it. Tell your friends, tell all your comic buddies that you know about this cool podcast where they learn about shows on the road and they learn to get better at comedy. They learn to look at failure in a different perspective so they can get better. Tell your comic buddies. Share our social media content. Rate and review the podcast. Those are the best ways to help The Art of Bombing. And I guess until we come back sometime in the future, I'm signing off for now. Thank you for constantly supporting this podcast. And now, enjoy this conversation with Joey Aiello.
And now, it's time for the stand-up soundbite.
When I was a kid, my grandfather used to say, "I love you. It's just that you got that face." It's like, "What's wrong with my face?" He goes, "Look in the mirror. What do you see?" "My face." "That's the problem." And I didn't know what he was talking about until I got into comedy, and I thought I was performing for a millionaire on his private property. It was a Christmas party. But I didn't know that he donated the party to this organization called Teen Challenge, which helps men and women overcome addiction, which is fantastic. But no one told me there was another sponsor that night, the Minnesota State Penitentiary. And they were bringing these guys from the prison, because they didn't sign up, they were court ordered, to the party, and from the party to a recovery house called Stevens House. I pulled into the parking lot, I seen the bus, I just didn't notice the bars on the bus. I just noticed a bunch of guys getting off in a single file line, so I got in line with them. We walked into the party. There's a guy mean mugging me, find out later, he's the guard assigned from the prison to watch the group that now he thinks I'm in. He goes, sit down. I'm like, okay. That guy's a Scrooge. The guys next to me are like, dude, I rap. I'm like, for real? I know how to play the drums. I start beating on the millionaire's table. So this guy can rap and the guard comes to life again. Hey! Stop beating on the table! I don't mean to be rude, sir, but is this Christmas? And you're really killing the vibe? He goes, what did you just say to me? Feliz Navidad. He goes, let me ask you something. When's the last time you've been written up? High school. He goes, what are you, some kind of comedian? Wondering when I'm supposed to go on. He goes, that's it. I've had it up to here with your lip. I'm about to put you on that bus and take you back to Stephen's house. Honestly, I have no idea, and I'm not trying to be rude. I said this to him. I go, well, shouldn't we call his mother? We shouldn't just be showing up to Stephen's house. All unannounced. He goes, I'm getting my notepad. And this guy, because I don't know who's supposed to announce me. They go, please welcome your comedian for the evening. I came, grabbed the mic out of the stand. I could see the guy to my right. I grabbed the mic. I looked over and that guy turned red, white, and blue. And I said, good thing I'm not going to Stephen's house. I'm a comedian. I'd rather do this. Hey, thank you so much. I'm Joey Ayala.
So you're in Branson, and you do a lot of shows there. You have your own show. How many times a week do you perform in Branson? Like during, obviously, the tourist season? Because I imagine in the wintertime, it's a lot different.
It's changed, you know. It's changed from once I moved here. When I first moved here, I took the job to come here because you can't get booked at Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday at 2 o'clock.
No.
And so that intrigued me. I was like, man, if I can get a gig Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday at 2, sign me up, you know, because then I can go on the road.
Oh, okay. I got you. So you're looking at it from the performing in the middle of the week, so then on the weekends you can go on the road.
Right.
Oh,
and,
okay.
I've taken it to a whole new level. Mm-hmm. I've taken it to, hey, who needs an open mic when you got real guests and not a bunch of haters in the back of the room?
Yeah, for sure.
Bringing my spirits down, okay?
Yeah. Well, it's an interesting thing too. Most comics, they see an opportunity to perform during the day and they're like, oh God, this is going to be the worst. And they don't want nothing to do with it. And you're the opposite. You're like, oh, I can perform during the day? That's amazing.
Well, that's where I started, you know, because I was new to town. So then I just had to weather. I had to weather the storm of my show going out of business and the locals trying to run me out of town, meaning you had to fit in with the culture scene here, mm-hmm. which is completely different than what I was doing in Minneapolis. I mean, that was a tough scene, too.
Yeah. Sorry to interrupt, but I just quick question before you get too into that. When you talk about locals, are you talking about local comedians and entertainers or like locals to that area?
When I moved here, And I, you know how it is when you're talking about something in the business, you got to keep it. You don't want to.
No, you don't want to. No, what I'm saying is, are you talking about the actual residents, like locals, or local entertainers?
Yes, the residents are the local entertainers. That's what's crazy. It's a fishbowl.
Well,
you know,
I
have 10,000 people that live in. But hold on, here's the thing: we have 10,000 people that live in the whole town, and millions of tourists that come every year. So it's a gatekeeper town.
Yeah, but
and when I moved here, it was a good old boy town.
Gotcha. So
it was
all about that's what I'm trying to get at.
It was all about who you knew.
Yeah.
And so when I open my mouth, I sound like a Yankee.
Okay, that's what I was trying to get to, because in comedy, we're talking comedy and entertainment, when we hear local, they assume it's local comedians. And that's where I was trying to clarify. Was it local comedians or just it was – I get it now. Okay.
And it offered a lot of challenges. I mean, I have an interracial marriage. I was one of the only ones with a show when I first came to town. Now it's become very diverse. I mean, it's changed, you know, a lot. But that's the older generation is moving out. And then it's become a family town because their tourists were all seniors. And the reason why that is because of how we function. We're in the Ozarks, so it's very hilly. And January, February, the whole town shuts down because they used to have buses. That's how they survived, was bus tours. And so these seniors, basically they're World War II vets, they would get on a bus because it's kind of like a reunion for them. They're traveling together and they're hanging out with the buddies that they fought in the war with and they get along. Well, newsflash, generations change. Nobody wants to be on a bus with people they don't know. Having conversations, our whole culture changed and it became, get your own vehicle. I ain't riding down there with you. And that they had to scramble to try to, well, who's going to fill that? Who's got some money? Who can we sell it to? And so it's becoming a family amusement park type place, which worked out great for me because at the time we just had our first baby when we moved here. Mm-hmm. And now we have two kids. And so our kids, it's like they're growing up in an amusement park. So they love it, you know, it worked out. But to get to this point, it was not easy because I knew nothing of the South. And they'll tell you they're not in the South. You know, they'll tell you because we're in Missouri, you know, and they're like, we're in the Midwest. And anytime you're straddling Arkansas, you're in the South. And I knew I was in trouble the first week because I was on a radio station and the lady goes, so what do you think of Branson? I go, oh, it's great to be here in the South. And she goes, what makes you think we're in the South? And I'm like, I don't know. The Confederate flag souvenir shop kind of gave it away because we got so many of those in Chicago. Try selling that on the South Side. You won't live long. And so it really is a culture thing.
Yeah.
It's not, it's an ignorance thing. I mean, think about it. If you are from an area and you've never been outside that area, how are you supposed to know? You know what I'm saying?
Oh, absolutely. I totally relate to that. I grew up, I was born and raised in South Dakota and I lived there for 32 years. Like I didn't move from South Dakota until I was 32 and I moved to California. So I didn't know anything about diversity really, you know, I lived in a very whitewashed town. Like there was very little diversity growing up. It's a lot more diverse now than my hometown is, but growing up, not really any diversity. So it's like I totally understand that mindset of if it's all you know, of course you're going to be ignorant.
Right. And it's been difficult for me because, I mean, I know I'm a white guy, but I love cultures and I'm not afraid of them. I'm not intimidated by them. I look at it as an adventure. Some people aren't. I'm not saying that makes that person wrong, but a lot of people it's more of a comfort thing.
Some people
are uncomfortable with going to another country and being in, you know, it's just uncomfortable. I don't look at it like that. I look at it like, man, I'm going to get to meet people. I'm not there to take from them. I'm there to learn and I'm there to just absorb. And it just enhance my life. But I don't go there to enhance my life. I go there for understanding and,
well, understanding can definitely enhance your life. I mean,
exactly.
I mean, having knowledge and less ignorance is definitely enhancement on life, at least in my perspective.
And when you go there without an agenda and you go there to just, you know, you meet the most beautiful people and you meet the most crazy people too. And you meet, You meet good people and bad people, and you have to make a decision. Who do I want to hang out with? So then you make those decisions, and you don't get hurt. You know, just make sure that you and when bad people do come around, you realize their intentions, and a lot of times when they know you know what they're up to, they just go away on their own. So, mm-hmm. I think when I go into a situation, I mean, I had to perform right after Trayvon Martin passed away. I performed at his church, and it was not a comfortable situation because of what had just happened. And here I am, the only white guy in the ticket. But what they didn't know, what the audience didn't know, is I had a gospel background. I worked at the age of 11. I was working with black gospel choirs out of Chicago. I started rapping at a young age. So I was always that white kid that was kind of like, oh, he's trying to be this. No, this is something that it would be like if I started in country music and I just happened to be black and everybody's like, you're trying to do our music. Like, no, he's got the gift to do that. Let him do it if he's good at it. And if he's not good at it, he'll just burn out and you'll never hear about it.
Yep, you'll find out.
When it's your passion, like that's what people got to understand. When it's the person's passion, why judge that person because it makes them happy? Let them do what they're passionate about, you know? And that's, so I never judge people's motives. I just know what I'm about and what I, you know, and even if you're not going in the same direction as me, I can still respect you. I don't have to do what you do and you don't have to do what I do. And, you know, and so some people feel uneasy about that because they want you to do what they do and they want you to think how they think. And so when you don't go along with it, you start getting, you know, the whatever that gaslighting word is.
Well, yeah, and you get resistance and all
clicky
all the things,
and you
yeah.
start to feel like you're in high school. And here's the thing. I was in special education my senior year in high school. I was never accepted in the real deal. I remember when I got my diploma, it didn't have all my stickers on it. It's supposed to say certified, like math certified. And I had nightmares for years that I wasn't certified, that I didn't belong to be there. And you know, I didn't get wrapped up in that. I just started doing what I like to do. I started rapping or, you know, doing something that it would be like if I started painting birdhouses and everybody's like, oh, look at the guy with the birdhouse. Hey, and then he becomes so good at it that people start buying them for $1 million. Now nobody's laughing anymore. Yeah, you see what I'm trying to say?
Yeah, no, exactly.
And that's the key. Like, I'm sorry that you're just finding out and you're cringed by the fact that I enjoy doing this stuff. You might not like it, but that's not my problem. That's what you have a problem with.
Yeah.
So carry on and go do what you're good at.
Yeah. Well, that's the thing with a lot of people. It isn't so much that they care what you're doing that makes you happy. It's that they're jealous that you are doing something that makes you happy.
Well, that's just it.
Our society has always been, and at least for me, my experience in the upper Midwest is, you know, you don't follow dreams. You graduate high school, maybe you go to school, or you get a job. Either way, you get married, you have a family, you get a mortgage, you get a, you know, the typical American dream, if you will. And that's right. What everybody's, you know, that's what's drilled into our heads at a very young age. And it's as we grow up, especially in our informative years. So then when you have people that are like, oh, no, I'm going to go against this ideology and I'm going to go do my own thing. People are
yes.
like, what? Yeah. How dare right. you? You know, right. I want to do my own thing, but I was told I have to do this.
Right. Right. And the only reason why I had to make that decision at a young age is because I got diagnosed with a rare muscle disease called familial periodic paralysis. And that was the reason why I moved to Minnesota. I moved to Minnesota to become a patient at Mayo Clinic.
Oh,
and at the age of 21, I had the equivalency of a massive stroke and I had to learn to walk again and talk again. I was doing music at the time and I was doing it too vigorously and didn't know that I had this neurological disease that was laying dormant. And I was delivering. I was actually working for a beer company. We'd deliver soda, but we'd also deliver beer. I think it was Miller, but it was kind of we'd do both. I think I was taking a keg downstairs. And I thought I threw my back out because my body just gave out and I fell down the stairs.
Oh, wow.
And the doctor basically said, well, then, you know, I started having problems in my legs and all this later. And the doctor said that kind of like if I got in a car accident, that accident activated the disease that lay dormant in my body. It was genetic. They said my father was the carrier and he passed it on.
Oh, okay. Interesting.
And so So my dad was in Vietnam. He dropped Agent Orange, and through the chemical, he dropped that chemical, or he didn't drop it, but he was a mechanic on the Air Force, in the Air Force. And so they believed that he contracted the illness by handling the chemical. So for him, it was, and they would use that chemical to kill plant life. And my illness is 95% Asian, and the other 5% is Hispanic. And those are the two places that they dropped Agent Orange, was Asia. And but it's also my particular kind is male dominant. And it's interesting because at the time, that's who was fighting in that war, were mm-hmm. predominantly male. And it just makes you get muscle weakness. It's a genetic, it's like a lot of things, tissue damage. Naturally, a lot of people go to lift weights, and when they lift weights, they tear muscle tissue. So mine doesn't heal. It heals, but it just goes back to whatever. So I get a lot of internal bruising and a lot of cramping.
Do you suppose that's why you tore your shoulder and didn't realize it for 2 years? We were talking about that prior to this, before we started.
I just found it out this week. I just went to the doctor. That's why I'm kind of bringing it up, because I'm in for 2 years. I really didn't. She told me some stuff that blew my mind, because she knew about my illness. That's another thing. My illness is very rare. It's 1 out of 100,000. It's hard to find doctors that know about it, mm-hmm. but sometimes they'll work with patients. A Mayo Clinic, the guy who wrote the book on my disease had flown in from Germany just to check on me, because I was one of the first white males that he had ever mm-hmm. really seen. Because this is back in like 90, this would have been back in 98. Mm-hmm. So, you know, and they said, you need to live with your parents for the rest of your life. And, you know, because at the time, you know, I was thinking about collecting Social Security. It looked like it was the end for me. You know?
Yeah, and which my dad's is very like, sad when you're only 21.
And my dad's like, please give him another prognosis. I want him to move out. And so I moved to Minnesota in that first year. Man, I ended up in the hospital like at least 18 times, because I kept getting sick. I'd collapse, and my disease is scary looking. So people freak out. They call, and it's a paralysis. So sometimes what it does is affects muscles in my face. And if you have problems in your mind one day, then it's not, well, it is in your mind, but the muscles in your face, yeah. then it goes in your legs the next day. It's never in the same place.
Yeah. It just kind of travels through your neurological system, essentially.
Right.
And just and messes with your muscles and things like
that. And I was a performer, and the doctor said, you'll never perform again. And I was like, next time you see me in this town, and this was in Rochester, I said, next time you see me in this town, I'll be performing. And 2 years later, I joined this music group, and we had a concert and I got hired. When I first got into comedy, I got hired to go to that auditorium in Rochester right by the Mayo Clinic and performed at a youth conference. And I'm telling you, I had tears afterwards, because someone found me crying, and they were like, what are you crying for? I'm like, I fulfilled my promise, but I have to be careful, because people are like, gosh, this guy's emotional. And, you know, well, you would be too, but when you have no one to celebrate those accomplishments with, and people just think you're crazy, you can't be concerned about that. Mm-hmm. You just got to go forward and just do what you do. And so I found peace in the techniques and developing techniques. Like I started playing drums at a young age, and I play by ear. I don't know how to read. So it was all about feel and rhythm. And, you know, I had never had a lesson. It was just watching and then just feeling the mm-hmm. rhythm. So getting into comedy, that's kind of where I'm a little different. I'm very rhythm orientated. I write rhythmically. Like everything's a beat to me. You know, when the audience laughs, it's a beat. But my words are my script, and I have the control to make them laugh mm-hmm. because I know what the beat is and they don't know. And so if I want to make them laugh here, you know, then so when I'm practicing with my comedy, obviously when I had the massive attack, I lost a lot of short-term memory. So it is very difficult for me to remember words. That's why I have to keep going over and over and over and over and over and over again in my head. So I walk around the house talking out loud and people think like, oh my gosh, this guy is crazy. But what I'm doing is I'm constantly practicing. That's why I have to hide it when I'm at a show backstage, because I'm walking back and forth. I'm doing lots of things. I'm keeping my muscles loose. Mm-hmm. And the doctor said, the reason why I didn't break the bone is because of the deficiency of the disease. There's a buildup of calcium in my bone, and anybody else would have broke the bone. So it actually protected me. It's so difficult though nowadays to be a comic. And I feel bad for the new people entering into comedy because it's like so many things you got to jump through. You know, if you weren't defeated before, it's like, you know, and I don't want to be that guy that is like, sounds so scary to a new person. They're like, well, I guess I'll never try. I want you to be successful because it's helped me find peace. It's helped me find joy in my life because when now I'm not focusing on what I can't do. I'm able to do. Mm-hmm. And I just love that. And I'm able to make people laugh. And, you know, I know that sounds cheesy to some comics, but in my situation, man, every time I get off that stage, I'm just very thankful. I'm just like, wow.
Now, how long have you been in Branson now? Just out of curiosity.
9 years.
Oh, wow. So almost a decade. That's amazing. And so you went down there.
I was in Minnesota for 13 years.
Yeah. Okay. Yep. Yeah. I've heard your name up here. You know, people have asked if I know.
I'm sure you have.
Like, I've heard the name,
but sure
I don't.
I'm sure you have, Mr. Dan. I'm sure you have. Big shout outs to some of my friends up there. How about that? Would you like some tater tots with some mixed in poison? Okay, Minnesota, nice here.
I'm sorry. Go nailing ahead. It all. Nailing it all. But
they
actually
any different. Hey, they need different than the rednecks down here. Bless your heart. Oh. Let me get the rope and put it around your neck.
Yeah,
it's the same thing. They don't think they're hicks. They are.
Oh yeah. Well, it's pretty much the whole Midwest is like that. No, it's interesting because I heard of you before I even moved here because I listened to Rick Roberts podcast and I think
I love Rick.
Yeah, and you've been on that podcast, but no, the reason I was just curious how long you'd been in Branson, and you said you went up there because of the performance. Like, so how did you take it? You said you took a job performing.
Yeah, so I started at Jim Stafford's Theater, and Jim Stafford is kind of a legend, and he worked with the Smothers Brothers, and he was a cool show to watch. You know, it was cool to be in his theater, but I was brought up to town by some people, and they were shady. They were leasing his theater, so it looked like I was being brought in by Jim, but I wasn't.
Oh,
I was being brought in by them. And then I kind of got ripped off and it was messy. And what was crazy was my experience in the Minneapolis comedy scene helped me be prepared to take on this. So the same games that I knew were played up there, I was prepared to survive mm-hmm. down here. And actually my agent had negotiated for me to come here because he wanted to bring more comics here. He wanted to start with me and see if we couldn't establish something. But he ended up jumping ship because he was just like, man, it's crazy. There's no money down there and nobody wants to pay, you know? And so he abandoned me, but he didn't abandon me altogether. He kept booking me nationally and that actually helped me to survive. So he was getting me shows all around the country. But I wasn't connecting with the locals yet. It would take me another 2 years. And I was going around to the resorts while I was with the people that wanted to fire me. And I was just doing, and they told me to stop doing it. They said, we're going to fight. We don't want you going to resorts because they didn't want me to meet the other entertainers. Mm-hmm. And I knew that if I go to an open mic and I have a good set, I'm going to get opportunities because it's not who you know, it's how you perform. If you perform well, then you'll get invited by other comics, you know,
or definitely.
Other producers.
I mean, it does help to know people, but you're right. If you have talent and you do good, you are going to get, then you're going to know them people, you know, you're going to make connections.
So what happens is the redneck tenors who just came off America's Got Talent. I don't know if you know who Todd Oliver is, but he was also on America's Got Talent. And he was on the Showboat in Branson and he moved to the Americana Theater. And so there was like three shows going on in that theater. And the redneck tenors were one of those. And I had a car and I was trying to get to a teaser to do a set. And I lost control of the car. Because it was raining and I went off the cliff and my car was just teetering and here comes the redneck tenors and are you okay? I'm like, yeah, I just had an accident. I think I'm all right. Okay, good. We're taking your spot. And boom, they take off. they take off to the it's not an open mic. It's a showcase. They're trying to go to the resort, perform for the guests to get them to come to their show.
Yeah.
So they do like a little sample. It's like a 7 minute. So it's like a showcase. Yeah. It's great. And so they get done. I'm still out there trying to push my car off. They come up again. Hey, are you all right? I go, yeah, they're good. We're going to the next one. We're taking your spot. They took off. And they didn't know me. I'm like, wow, what a bunch of jerks. But I'm like, that's it. I'm going to beat them to the next resort. So I rush. I jump in. I try to get my car to move. And it's like, I got square tires now. And it's like, and I'm only like a half a mile away from my house. So I drop that car that's totaled, we find out later. And I pick up the only car that we have. And I go to Westgate. And it's just adrenaline is pushing me to drive there. And I get out of the car and they see me and they start running towards the door to try to beat. Because whoever arrives to the resort and gets there first goes up so they don't have to sit through your act. And so these dudes are brutal, right? And they're funny though. I love them. We're good friends now. And we get to the, they beat me to the door and the adrenaline starts to wear off. And one of these kids entertainers, their mom was their manager. And she comes up to me. She goes, oh my God, you don't look good. I'm like, yeah, I just got in a car accident. She goes, well, let us drive you home. Yeah, but I got my car. Well, my son will drive your car and you can ride with me. And I'm like, okay. So this is like not even an hour and a half later, they go to drop me off and she doesn't know where the entrance is. So she stops and here comes her son with my car and he loses control and smashes in the back with my car.
Oh so my God.
Two accidents in one day. And I lost both of my cars. The Redneck Tenors hear about this in town. When I show up the next week and get dropped off by somebody, they were like, hey, man, you want to be in our show? and so they let me come over after I lost, you know, because I just got fired from the people who were ripping me off and they were going to replace me. And they brought me over. They were doing 500 a night and they didn't even have me open. They had me come in the middle and do my stand-up. And I survived because my DVD had come out and I was selling that and I was surviving on that. But I started outselling them in merch. And I'll never forget Matthew Lord, who I love. He goes, you're like that little cat that we felt bad for. So we put a dish in the alley and now you just won't go away. And that was his polite way of saying, okay, you're out of here. But that little help that they gave me helped me get noticed in town and I started getting invites. And in 2018, I won Comedian of the Year. And that's a huge accomplishment because, you know, it doesn't mean anything to the rest of the world. You know, it's funny. Ken Reed, who's a good friend of mine, he's like, don't tell anybody you won that award outside of Branson. It doesn't mean anything, but it means everything because I was able to come to a whole different culture and you know, I don't necessarily completely fit in, but man, I'm telling you, we won a lot of battles and we're still here. And it's a great place to raise a family. So I'm happy about that. So.
That's awesome. Well, now that we talked about that, about being in Branson and doing comedy and all the trials and tribulations you had to face in Branson and you're on your, you know, doing fine now. We got to talk about the bombing because having a career where you, you know, you've been doing comedy for 20 some years, you definitely got some good stories, I'm sure. So I want to hear one of your stories of a time where you felt like you had a really bad show or you bombed really bad.
So when we first moved here and we're at the Jim Stafford Theater, that theater has 900 seats. And they were selling my tickets for like, they wanted me to do a 90-minute comedy show. Like, okay. I'm like, I just moved to town. I don't even know. And they sell two tickets. You got a show tonight. We got two tickets sold.
Oh, geez.
The theater. I'm like, two tickets? And there was just this couple, an older couple, and I come out and they want me to do 90 minutes. And I basically just sat on the thing and talked to them. And it was weird because towards the end of the 90 minutes, she goes, I'm sorry, could you speak up?
Oh, no.
So then I only had two people in a 900 seat theater. And then I discover right before I'm done that she didn't really hear anything. So it was a horrible feeling.
Oh, I'm sure.
It was like isolation and just, you know, how could I ever? So yeah, so I probably should have told that story first, and then said how yeah how, that's why it meant everything to me.
Yeah. No, that's amazing. Because it's already hard when you do comedy in a room that's big and there's, you know, a small audience, you know, because, and it seems too, like when you have that situation, the audience is always so spread out, you know, like you got this big room, but they're not, instead of putting all the people like together, like up front, there'll be like a little pocket here, a little pocket there. Nobody's sitting up front, you know?
Oh man. Yeah. You're on an island. You're just on an island.
Yep.
You know, I don't know if you ever interviewed Mark Poulos, cause he tells that story. Cause a lot of us comics, I was performing at that time when Black Bear Casino used to have the stage, and it was Benny and I think Shannon Thompson, I think they brought me up there, and that was when like you'd stand on the middle of the stage, you'd tell your joke, and they were playing slots around you.
Oh yeah, I've heard of shows like that.
Like yeah, that was weird. But nothing compares to the worst show that I ever did was, but it actually, what it didn't turn out bad, but it was, I would say the good thing is I went through that Branson experience first. It happened just a couple years ago. I was up in Joplin and they wanted to do this thing called United at the Stadium because they had a lot of suicides and there were a lot of young people. I guess 65% of the deaths were all suicide, and it was coming into the school year like now, and they wanted to try to prevent it. So they booked me to do comedy. I liked the event. I thought they had food trucks. It was outside. You know, I don't like outside events.
Nobody is a big fan. Well, so now that we went through a pandemic, people are more excited about doing outdoor comedy than they were prior to that.
Right. It's like, well, what is this? Is it a stadium? They said, yeah, it's a football stadium, and we're going to pack it because we're giving away free food. So all these people are coming for free food. And the stadium looked awesome, you know, and they're coming in, and they have these six chairs set up like a roast dais. And then they got one of those podiums. I don't like podiums. Okay. I'm like, I don't need your podium. Just give me a great mic stand and a stage. And, you know, I'm like, where's the stage? And it was like a little plastic. We're on the football field.
Yeah.
There's like a little plastic cover. And then they got one of them portable speaker systems for this whole
thing. Oh my God.
And it's Bluetooth, you know? And that's not the worst part. So I like to meet the people. A lot of times, you know, the longer you get into comedy, you want to know who's up before you. Want to know what you're going to have to overcome, you know. And especially when the guy tells you, hey, man, we're going to have these people go on before you. When you thought you, I was like, I'd rather go first.
Yeah.
And I said, well, what are they? Well, they're going to talk about their loved ones because this is a suicide prevention and they lost loved ones. And so they're just going to get up and speak. And I'm like, for how long? Just like, each one is only going to do 5 minutes. And I'm like, okay. So they get up with like books and they put them on each speaker walks up and puts a book on the thing. And they got like a catalog of pictures. And my husband killed himself and starts crying and talks for 15 minutes. The next one comes up. My son killed himself, 15 minutes. Mm-hmm. The next one, I have a friend who's a pastor. He's in the audience. He goes, after he tells me, the show, he goes, I really thought about killing myself at the Prevent You From Killing Yourself show, you know, and I'm sitting there. I look like Pee Wee Herman when he goes down into the Alamo and he wants to see if there's a basement. I'm sitting in the dais like, just get me up here. Like, you know, how am I supposed to follow this? And the next person, and then this football player, he gets up all cocky. He goes on for 30 minutes. When we started, it was light out. Now it's dark. People are leaving the stadium like the Detroit Lions are playing, you know, just exiting left and right. And he's the last person that just needs to wrap it up so I can come on stage. And finally he's done. And I'm like, I'm clapping loud. Oh, moved. I was moved. Get out of here. You know? So I know I need to make a lot of noise to get these people to come back. So I get up and I just knock the podium over. And I'm like, I'm the keynote speaker and I don't even have any notes. And I start just cracking jokes left and right to get their attention. Just quick ones, you know. And I'm just making fun of everything. There's balloons. I'm like, be honest with me. You didn't come here to hear about all that. You came here for the free food and the balloon. And I grab the balloon and I'm walking around and I give it to somebody. And I'm just being as disruptive as I can be. And all of a sudden, everybody starts coming back into the stadium. And I had my DVD when they released, I sold everyone one of them. It was unbelievable. So it was one of the most excruciating shows because I had to work so hard to do it. And it was one of them things where it's like, it was the first time where I wasn't upset, but I was like, who? Are you trying to torture comics? Like, you just, you try not to take it personal, but you're like, who put this together?
Right. Like, yeah.
But you realize they just don't know. They don't know. They don't know how to do it. They just think, oh, we got comedy. But if you're going to have comedy and suicide stories, swap them out a little bit, you know, especially if you want a clean comedian. So it's a clean event. They want really dark stories and a clean comic.
Yeah.
Who's happy, you know, I'm not happy. I mean, I've had a lot of pain in my life, so I can go deep. But if you call it a comedy show, you can't start out that way. You know what I'm saying? It makes it that much harder to get people up.
Yeah, you know? No, absolutely. The bumming of bombing, the dreadful feeling you get when you have a show that goes not how you want it. How does that affect you, and how has it changed over the years? Like, how long does it last for you, that feeling?
I try to revert back to what I know. So because I started with the mechanics of like drumming and things like that, I just watch the tape, or, you know, if it really hurt me, I take a couple of days off and, you know, I try to tape myself, or if I know there was any footage of that, I go back and see how I could have better prepared in the situation. Like it's uncomfortable for me right now in this setting, 'cause I feel like I have to get to the point. But when I'm on stage, it's easy because I am so fast speed. But sometimes the culture's changed, so people are more like, bro, slow it down. Okay, use words.
They need to understand you.
Right. So when I get off the stage, I go, why did I do? Was it the jokes? No. Was it the people? Maybe they don't like speed. And that moving here let me know. I have to understand the culture I'm in. I have to understand where I'm at, what they're into. And I don't have to stereotype them. I just have to say, do I have an experience that I can relate? And if I can't, well, then just do me, do what I do. Mm-hmm. I'm going to do me anyways. But my point is, it's important to know your audience.
Oh, absolutely.
And you have to go through your material and just, you know.
Mm-hmm. I was just going to ask, do you do anything like more specific when you analyze your sets and stuff? Is there certain things that you do while you're watching back that you look for or try?
Well, not only do I watch back my set and what I said, you know, now that I'm headlining a lot, there's people in front of me. That's become very helpful for me to make the right decisions. So it's really important for me to watch who's up in front of me. Because if they're bombing, I'm listening to their material.
Oh, yeah. Yep. To see what they're
I'm using. Not listening to their material so that I can take it or any of that. I'm listening what worked. What if they get a laugh, that's a beat. How did they get that beat? What beat? It's kind of like if you DJ, you take requests. Why do you take requests? You want to know what these people like to listen to. Mm-hmm. So the longer you do this, you get reads. You read the audience. Subtle things, and you start looking at what's on the stage. It gives you a better advantage to go there, and that's what's hard with Zoom shows now.
Oh yeah,
it comes on, and you're just they're looking at you. They don't know, you
looking
know,
at each other.
yes,
yeah. Zoom comedy is definitely an interesting thing. When you tell a joke that doesn't get the laugh, like when you have a joke that works 9 out of 10 times, and then that one time it doesn't work. What goes through your mind, or when you tell a joke that just doesn't land, what goes through your mind at that moment?
A lot of times, like what I was saying, I know naturally, and I think my family life has helped me a lot. Like my wife has helped me a lot because she's just a regular person. She doesn't care about entertainment. So a lot of times it's like, hey, you need to slow down. And so if I'm going fast and that crowd isn't into fast, I just think of my wife. I just go in a different direction. Okay, so now I'm practicing my bits in different ways. I was always a high speed, go fast. If the culture's changed, it's like a beat. You know, when I used to rap, the styles would change. The lyrics never did, but the styles did. The beats did. Hip-hop beats are all similar. but the beats used to be doom, ba, the doom, doom, ba. But then as it progressed and it got cooler and cooler, it doom, ga, doom, 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 ga, it backbeats and different mm-hmm. beats. And so but it's all the same rap. You just have to know how to match it to that rhythm, you know? And so I look at the rhythm of the crowd. Okay. Body language. They're a mirror to me, the way they're sitting, you know? And as I'm going, if they start to loosen up, I start to realize, oh, I'm on to something. So I look at them in their body language to read them and I use my jokes like I'm a quarterback just going through it, just different plays. Okay, that play didn't work. And so I try to think like that, so I take the emotion out of it, so I don't beat myself up. Mm-hmm. And I look at it like a boxing match. I'm trying to knock them out. You know what I'm saying? And so what people will do is they'll groan, like they knew that joke. I knew where you were going with that. So that's why I didn't hit, because it wasn't a punchline.
Yeah.
They knew where it was going, so they blocked it.
Yeah, there was no misdirect.
Right. So it makes you work harder. And so a lot of us are just out of shape because we haven't had a chance to, you know, so that's why I moved to Branson, so that I could perform at resorts. I got a show tonight, and I don't know who's going to come. Last week I had 3 people in a room that only fits 30. So I have smaller resort shows now, smaller rooms mm-hmm. that mirror what the clubs look like, but it's just me for an hour. And but they pay to get in, so I have to bring it. But yet I try to use it to work on new stuff, because working on a new joke is like getting put on the cash register at McDonald's and for the first time. You know what money looks like, you know how to type, but the buttons feel weird, and it's a dinner rush, and mm-hmm. it's the pressure coming at you.
Yeah.
And so just if you don't have your material memorized inside out, and you haven't worked on different ways to say it, what are you going to do? You know, so don't beat yourself up. Maybe you just need to practice more. You need to get back and go back to the craft and keep working on that. Mm-hmm. You know?
Yeah, absolutely. Now that we talked about some of the fun, some of the stuff, you know, with the comedy and getting into the nuts and bolts of it and the bombing, the bad stuff, I like to go more positive towards the end. One thing I always like, I've created an Art of Bombing playlist on Spotify called the Comedy Get Pumped playlist. And it's just it's a playlist of songs that get comedians pumped, not necessarily to perform comedy, just pumped for anything. Is there a song that gets you pumped?
Oh man. Did you put that in the question?
No, because I don't give my guests all the questions. We can't have an organic conversation.
It's funny. I've been DJing. I've been DJing a pool party every day. Actually, I got at 1 o'clock. I do it for Westgate. I use it to promote. And so, yeah, I've been playing songs. I wonder if I had my phone on me. Give me a second. I just got to go to my playlist.
Okay, you got a song that you got to find.
Yes. I just go and look at what I usually play, because I've been discovering new music and, you know, stuff that I never really, really known. There's this song. Well, it's an old Sinatra song. He shot me down, bang, bang. I hit the ground, bang, bang. What an awful sound, bang, bang. My baby shot me. And but they made like a DJ mix to it. So I
went
down, 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 down. And they mixed it. And I'm like, I don't know what song this is, but that is so dope. So I listen to that. That gets me hyped, you know.
Okay.
Because I think
I'm sure I can like find that.
It's the contrast of, let me see. It's the contrast of the slow, and then when that beat drops, I just like
it.
It's
hype to me. All right. I'm sure I can find it with that description. Cool. And then I like to hear a positive story, like one of your best gigs that you've got to do in your career, or a favorite gig, rather.
Oh, I was going to say one other song, Coming In Hot. I like that song, too.
Coming
In Hot. Yeah.
Who sings that?
He's a rapper. Coming In Hot. You'll find him. Yeah. I love that song.
All right, Coming In Hot. I got him. Got him. Bang Bang and Coming In Hot. Bang Bang DJ remix and Coming In Hot.
Yeah, well, let me see who sings that. I got that. Because the thing is, I found that.
Just don't play
it. I mean,
it's
not my favorite song, but it was just something I like. David Guetta.
Oh, okay.
G-U-E-T-T-A.
No, no worries. All right. Now, like I said, I like to talk about one of your, I like to hear a story about a gig that was your favorite or one of your best gigs. So let's hear about that. What's been, in your career, what's been your favorite gig so far?
Oh, man, I've had some really, really cool gigs like Gamage Theater performing at Arizona State University. That was awesome. It was a September gig for freshmen coming back, 3,000 freshmen.
Wow. Orientation.
And it was a theater. Yes. Yeah. It was like, it's called ASU's First Laugh. And they basically brought me in and it was so cool, man. Like Andrew Frank Lloyd Wright built the theater. And instead of the rows going back like a normal theater, it came out this way. And it was just like on top of you. So oh, wow. When the crowd laughed, the feeling was just, it was surreal. It was really cool. It was a lot different than big auditoriums where the echo, they don't laugh right away because you gotta do a lot of pauses to wait for it to come back to you. So that was really, really, really cool.
That's awesome.
That was cool. Theater. I love the old theaters, mm-hmm. like the Fox Theater and performed the Fox Theater and in Joplin. That was really the old Fox Theater. That was just beautiful. I love history and just being on some of those stages is just, it's really cool, mm-hmm. you know, because I like the older comedy, you know, or vaudeville days. Just it was kind of cool, you know what I'm saying? Like, so just trying to think what other shows. What are some of your favorite shows? What have you done so far?
Oh, I've done, I mean, right now, my favorite show that I've probably done, I mean, I've done a lot of fun stuff, but it was probably my Dry Bar taping. It was just a great experience. Over.
Yes, yeah. Dry Bar was phenomenal. I mean, I was injured. Mm-hmm. I fell 2 days before, so that initial injury happened 2 days before, but the staff, so nice. Mm-hmm. You know, I worked at Club 3 Degrees in Minneapolis, and it looked a lot like that.
Oh,
so
right.
That was another one of my favorite gigs. That was a favorite job because I had my own show in that club and it was laid out the same way Dry Bar Studios is laid out.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
Yeah, the upstairs. Yeah.
Oh, nice.
And it's a club now in Minneapolis. It was 3 Degrees. It was across the street from the old Quest. It's right on the same street as the Minnesota Twins Stadium.
Yeah. Okay. I was going to say most
of this
is...
I think it's a brewery or something like that.
Most of this is foreign to me because I've only lived here for a couple of years, so I'm not I didn't grow up here, so this is all foreign to me. But all right, well, the final thing I like to do, we play a game called Pick a Number. You're going to pick a number between 1 and 20. I'm going to ask you the corresponding question. It may or may not be related to comedy, so pick a number.
3.
All right, what ridiculous thing has someone tricked you into doing or believing? That's a fun one. This is the first time that question has come up. First time somebody picked number 3. I like it. This is a tough one. I mean, if you're not a gullible person, when I was younger, I used to be a little gullible. People would say things to me and I just believe them. But that was before you could fact check people. Now, somebody says something ridiculous, you can just pull out your phone and Google it.
Well, tricked me into doing, I was young, I was at a youth camp, and there was this girl that I liked. It was just, I just liked her a lot, you know, and we got on stage, and they were doing those stupid games they do, and I only participated because she participated, right? Well, then we end up going up against each other, right?
Oh,
so
no.
we're doing weird games. We're young, but we're doing weird, like, kid games, and then... they pull out a goldfish and they're like, okay, put this in your mouth. And I was like, okay, and put it in my mouth. And she put it in her mouth and they're like, now swallow it. So I decided I had to beat her or do something crazy. And so I chewed it. And when I chewed it, it exploded in my mouth and the texture made me want to hurl, but I couldn't do it in front of her because I didn't want to embarrass myself, and I ended up being that. So not only did I chew it, then I swallowed it, and I felt sick all day. And so I felt tricked in some ways because it was like I would have never ever ever done that on my own, but so because I had the crush on this girl.
Potential love tricked you into chewing a goldfish. That's pretty amazing.
Isn't that something?
Oh. Yeah.
I never told that story. So
that's an awesome story. That gave me the... As soon as you said you chewed it, I was just like, oh, that sounds horrible. Well, this has been fun. Where can people find you? Where direct people to your social media or your social presence, online presence?
Please. I'm on Facebook. I'm on Instagram. You can check out my website, joeyilocomedy.com, if you'd like to book me. I work clean. I do a lot of corporate stuff. I'm online. I'm willing to do that too. So love to do that. And so that's kind of what I'm doing. I'm basically performing here. If you ever come to Branson, I'm at Westgate Resorts. You can come find me there. Wayne Burfine checked in. You had him on a show as a guest. Him and his wife checked into that. They were passing through town, stayed at the resort, and his wife is checking in, and she's looking at the activities guide like, is this our Joey? Because we've been friends for years. And they came to my show, and I let him middle in my show because he was there. I let him get up and it was fun. So yeah, come see me. I mean, if you know me, if you're from the Minneapolis comedy scene, you're ever on vacation coming through Westgate Resorts, Branson Woods is the location I'm at. And I usually do my shows on Wednesdays. And then I'm on the Green Mountain Resort currently this year on Tuesday nights. It is usually reserved for the guests staying on property, mm-hmm. but you know, message me on Messenger or Facebook if you're on your way. Just let me know you're coming, and I'll let you know how to get through security.
You got the inside. You got the inside track
to
go.
We'll
see.
We'll give you the special. I'm not going to give you the runaround. Okay, we'll hook you up. We'll give you the VIP.
I love it. All right. Well, thank you so much for doing this.
Thank you, buddy. Thanks for having me. Really appreciate it.
This has been brought to you by Dead and Mellow. Follow us on all your social media platforms and shop around at deadandmellow.com to see all of our stand-up, music, and podcast releases. Thank you, and God bless America.
All right, see you later.
See you.
Are we actually leaving or just it?
The Art of Bombing is a Blitzed Entertainment production. Hosted and produced by me, Dan Bublitz Jr. The stand-up spotlight bumper was produced by Joe Nicola Music. The Art of Bombing theme music was written and performed by John Holt. All other music was used under Creative Commons licensing. All stand-up audio clips were used with permission from the comedians. You can help the podcast by subscribing, leaving a 5-star rating, and a review. For previous episodes, merch, blogs, and more, please visit theartofbombingpod.com. And remember, stay safe so you can live to love.